a bit of a new process, so we'll start at the basics. I want to start with the UI Trust Fund for Good Factor and Social Cost Calculation.
I talked to Dave. He's pretty excited about all these functional calculations. We're going to keep an eye on him.
I did not bring my pillow with me.
Alright, so just a basic recap of our trust fund. This is contributed 100% from employers, and it is used only to pay benefits. Each year we calculate a new contribution rate for employers, and that formula is based on a benefit cost ratio, essentially how much they were liable for benefits in the last 4 years compared to their total wages, total taxable wages. There's a reserve factor that's set based on the health of the trust fund, and then there's a social cost rate, which are unemployment benefits that are paid out that can be attributed to any particular employer account. So bottom line, the status of our trust fund is very healthy this year. We were able to see a reduction in all three of those elements just based on the improving economy. So the benefit cost ratio in this reserve factor, that only applies to about 27% of all of our employers. 73% of Utah employers don't have any benefit costs. So they qualify for the maximum rate, which ends up being 0.002 this year. So it works out to $64.40 per employee. So that's good. It's about a one-third decrease from what the minimum rate was last year. So we're excited about that. For the 27% of employers that do have benefit costs, the look back in terms of how much they're being held liable for, we're shifting it forward 1 year. So instead of going back to 2011, we're now only going back to 2012 and taking up 2015. So actually, if you look at claims volume from 2011 and how it changed to 2015, nearly cut in half. So the benefit cost ratio for employers that did experience unemployment will be decreasing because of that shift in the look back. And then the health of the trust fund. If you look at the trust fund balance projection, so blue lines indicate our minimum and maximum reserve level. Essentially, we want to identify how much should be in this trust fund if we were to experience another recession. If the economy had a downswing and we didn't collect any more contributions, how much would it take to pay 18 months of benefits? And how much would it take to pay 24 months of benefits? And if we're right there in between those blue lines, we're considered to have a healthy trust fund. Because as of June 30th, 2016, we are at $881 million, which was right below the maximum line, so reserve factor is 1.0. So there's not any additional cost to employers because of our healthy trust fund. Any questions? I know that's a lot of data to dig into at 2:40 in the afternoon. All right, so projections going forward, what's going on?
I'm just thrilled that we're making great progress compared to a few years ago.
Absolutely. And to kind of bring some historical perspective, in the depths of the recession, our trust fund got as low as $253 million, and we were paying about that in benefits each week. And so to have it up at $881 billion, we're in a much better spot this year.
Sorry, I'm late.
Okay.
Yes, I apologize. I was on an interview panel and they ran late, so it's good to be with you guys. Good to be here.
So, John Member Casey Cameron, our Deputy Director.
Hi. Oh. Friendly face over on the room.
The meeting's young, Casey.
Uh-oh, Matt. I don't seem
friendly. So, we are getting into trust funds.
Okay.
We can go back and do a
good
of the list.
Perfect.
Great. So employers were notified of their 2016 contribution rates. We just mailed those out last week. And as the council was about to even appreciate a bit of our swag, we included a RAC card that basically talks about distinguishing between independent contractors and employees. And we also included a magnet that advertises our electronic correspondence and shows our due dates for quarterly rates. So. the trust fund going forward, going back to the chart with the blue lines, is we anticipate that if we continue at our current rate, in 2016 at the end of June, we will be above the maximum level, which would mean that in 2017, that reserve factor would go down to 0.95, essentially giving the 27% of employers that do have benefit costs an additional 5% cut in their liability. So 2016 is good, and if we continue on that trajectory, then 2017 would be good. Bit of a historical perspective. Average employer unemployment insurance tax credit is right here. So it's interesting to see how we compare on the national scale. The blue line is the national average for employer liability tax rate, and the red line is the Utah average. You'll notice that from 2006, you in. And then for that quarter of those lawyers that don't qualify for the minimum that do have some sort of benefit experiencing, the average rate is 1.62%, which works out to about $521 per employee per year. So we saw it increase about 4% more employers in 2016 are eligible for that minimum rate. Another time the strength of the trust fund. And then included in your packet as well is the most recent press release that we did last week, essentially celebrating the fact that with the help of trust funds, employers can request to be paid to their rates this year. So therein lies the trust fund update. Do you have any questions or comments?
Just having been on the council for a long time, I know it's been sort of painful to build the statute the way that we have, but quite frankly, it appears to be working. I think that it worked very well during that recessionary period, and again, it was very painful, especially for a lot of riches guys, but I just, you know, hats off to the department and the little role that maybe we play as a council as well in helping to build that statute. Yeah, it really does work.
It's interesting that of the 15 states that were able to retain solvency, 11 of them had indexed both their weekly benefit amount and their taxable wage base to the average weekly wage. So having that in statute without requiring some sort of overt action from a legislative body can help. I know historically this council has been able to participate in some very in-depth and some very powerful discussions around the statute and surrounding the potential changes to retain solvency. So looking for us at this particular period in our economy, we're in a good place. Down the road, where things to shift, where we should experience a downswing, then I would look to this council to help provide us with insight on what we might do to accommodate that or to mitigate the impact it could have on employers.
We're happy to argue about whatever issues you want
to bring. Well, what does the future look like?
So,
what do you guys think?
Do you want to take that one, Casey?
Go ahead. I can't slow her down. She was going, so we'll let her go.
So, you know, there are some that would say that we're due for another recession just by nature of the economic business cycle being 5 to 7 years, and that the last recession has been about 5 to 7 years, ended about 5 to 7 years ago. In talking with our workforce research and analysis division, we don't anticipate, there's no evidence to show that we're due for another recession beyond the fact that years have passed. We don't anticipate anything changing in the Utah economy that would cause another recession. It would, if something were to happen, it would more be a matter on the national stage. And at that, we wouldn't expect it to have the same sort of impact that the 2009 recession had with us. It would be much more, much lower impact with the Utah consumer economy.
Is that the answer you wanted, Rich?
We're optimistic. We're seeing good things for the next few years, which is nice to be able to say.
I'd agree with that. We don't see anything on the horizon, at least in the manufacturing side, that would indicate any. It's probably the other way.
I've been the oil and gas that much.
Other than that, that's
So what is the unemployment rate? 3.4?
3.6.
At about 3%, you've got full employment. If you can fog them in and you want a job, you have one.
Yeah.
other areas of the state that still struggle with poverty and you know, their strategies and things like that that we're working on as a department. But for the most part, I think we're happy. I think they're headed. It sounds like you guys are as well.
We need more workers.
That's what we're hearing a lot about. Yeah. Hearing a lot about. For the sales team, so.
We're all competing for the same commodity.
Yeah.
There's not enough of them.
Have I got a deal for you?
Hey, I'm a trustee on some of those galleries. I don't want to read them, buddy.
We just need to expand.
Okay.
So just one last note before you move on to the next agenda item. We did include our monetary evaluation for 2016. Essentially, this just shows that the taxable wage is increasing. It'll be $32,200. And the maximum weekly benefit amount for people collecting unemployment is increasing from $496 to $509. So on average, the typical UCOP claimant this year, they usually qualify for about $360 a week for 21 weeks. We do have one of the lowest durations in the nation, and so of the 21 weeks they could get, on average, people generally collect between 12 and 13 weeks.
Sure. So last time we met, August, August 17th, and I think I messed with that meeting too. Just like, yeah. So, does everybody have a copy of the minutes? Anyone had a chance to review them? Any changes to make?
I have one change.
Okay.
Diane Lewis is with the labor, not the steel workers on the front page.
Okay. Noted. Any other changes? Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved. We did. Correction.
Okay. And a second?
Correction.
Okay. We'll move to approve the minutes. Thank you.
Just a suggestion. I don't know if it's possible to get us these ahead of time so that we can take over time and look them over before we get here. That would be great if we could just see them ahead of time.
You mean the minutes or the package?
Well, it'd be nice to see the whole package. But at least a minute.
I want to say they went out emailed. Quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I read them over before I got there.
I didn't see them come out, so maybe.
Do you want to reach out with the agenda?
Go out with the agenda? It'd be nice if we got the agenda and the whole packet together and then you can just edit that.
Because
I didn't get the agenda.
I think we can accommodate that.
Okay.
That suggestion. Okay, well, we'll move along then. Looks like Michelle, you've got several other items here and the county has as well, so move along.
All right, HUB funding. So HUB, we had talked about this last year going into the legislative session. It's the computer system we use to make our benefit payments. In your packet, you'll see a modernization project brief. That's about 4 pages long. And so, essentially, with our benefit system, we had originally built it on a Mercado platform, and then a few years in, we found out from the company that the maintenance costs were going to be increasing by 500%. And so, we looked at our alternatives, we evaluated the benefit of continuing in that system versus rewriting it to avoid the maintenance costs, and ultimately made the decision to rewrite it into a .NET environment. And we're approaching this technology project by going module by module. So rather than shutting off the old system overnight and starting the new one, right now we currently have 3 different teams that are operating in the new system, and it's communicating with the old system until we can get those other units up and running. So most important to the council that I wanted to make you aware of is on page 4, it talks about the funding for this project. because this is a system that we use to process wage records, to evaluate claim eligibility, to evaluate overpayments, it's quite an elaborate system, and I wanted to make you aware of the costs of that, both what we've spent and what we're asking for going forward. We started the project in January of 2013. We expect to finish by June 30th of 2018. Thus far, in terms of DWS staff and then also our Department of Technology, supporting that project, we've spent about $5.1 million. Half of that was paid out of the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act fund, and then the remaining half was paid out of our administrative grant that the Department of Labor authorizes to fund the unemployment insurance program. And just for clarification purposes, that's for administration. It's separate from the trust fund, which we just talked about, which is to pay down that. So moving forward, last legislative session, after discussing with this council, we have $20 million that is currently sitting in the unemployment trust fund that was awarded to the state of Utah for modernizing our benefits eligibility. And that money is encouraged by Department of Labor to be used for modernization efforts and unemployment program. It's fascinating hearing from other states across the nation and the limitations they have with the unemployment program from having to program it on outdated systems. There are some states that are still using a DOS or DOS system. So Utah is already ahead of the curve with our existing system, and I think .NET will take us further with that. So last legislative session, we were able to appropriate $2 million of that $20 million towards this modernization project. What we're asking for this year with the governor's budget is to include an additional $1.6 million for fiscal year 2016, and then to request $4 million for fiscal year 2017. So bottom line is we expect to finish this project end of June 2018, and it's going to be the process.
So we're about halfway through. Are we on target still? Are there cost overrides? Are we looking at delays in the process? Give us kind of an update as to how it's working.
Absolutely. And on the second and third page, we included some milestones about the first up to this point. So, fiscal year 14, we were able to roll out an automation to our benefit overpayment team, which is the team that does cross-factors to identify improper payments. Because of that automation and including a section where we can allow employers to respond online, we've had about 40% of employers that are now responding to our request for information online, which speeds up the processing by about, it goes from 28.3 weeks for a paper response to 28.3 days to 16.3 days. So fairly significant improvement in terms of being able to resolve these pending overpayments, which protects the integrity of the fund. If we can stop the payments sooner, then we can stop more money from going out the door. In fiscal year 15, as part of this rewrite, we did include a cross-match with a company called APRIS, which allows us to check unemployment claims against incarceration records across the nation. And we also instituted the SIDE system, and Justin, help me out with the acronym. State Information.
Data Exchange,
yes. And that is part of what the magnet that's included in your packet is to promote. We find that when employers respond to our graduation information online, we're able to process that in 5.4 days as opposed to 8.3 days when it comes to a response. So we've seen some improved efficiencies by having this, this conversion go through.
Can you help me understand the value of an automated cross match with APRIS for checking active unemployment claims against incarceration records? Mm-hmm. What's the benefit to that?
And so, in order to qualify for benefits, we need to be able and available and actively seeking full time work. And so, by cross checking against incarceration records, we're able to see if someone is incarcerated and still filing unemployment claims. To do some fact checking of are they still able and available for work.
Oh, I got it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So the governor's budget comes up next.
Mm-hmm.
And
Bridges over there?
He thought it was all going to higher ed.
I thought that, you know, I'm just trying to do the math, that's all.
And I think something that's important to note is the $20 million that's currently sitting in the trust fund for this that we received because of our previous modernization, that is not included in the calculation when we identify employer contribution rate. So using that money for modernization purposes, which is what it's encouraged to be used for, does not in any way impact employer liability.
Didn't that money go into the trust fund, though? Why did it ever go into the trust fund if it was designated for modernization?
Mm-hmm. And so that's the judgment call that each state that receives is able to make. We could have set it in a separate fund and just use it for modernization efforts. The benefit of putting it right into the trust fund is that, especially during the recession when we were at that $253 million balance, we would have been able to use that money to pay a little bit more in benefits without requiring an appropriation from the legislature. And then now that we're using it for another reason, for the modernization that was intended, it does require that appropriation. So it was basically just one more catch-all for increasing benefit levels. No, we haven't. So, and actually, thanks for bringing that up again. As with any technology project of this scale, especially when it spans multiple years, we have seen some delays caused by staffing turnover. The improving economy, the strong economy is great, but I imagine, like a lot of employers out there, we've had turnover in our contractors. And so we can plan out a particular module and then find out that the lead contractor has found a job somewhere else for maybe a higher rate of pay. So we have to go back and replan that project. So we've seen a few delays with that, but nothing to do with that.
You're having an employment problem as well.
We're right there with that.
Talk to Dale. I can help you. I've got the pen.
Excellent. Dale, can you talk to .NET programmers?
I'll find you.
All right. Any further questions?
Matthew, you're on. You want to talk about professional legislation?
Okay. So it is that fun time of year where we get to start talking about the legislative session. Luckily, when my full-time job turns into three full-time jobs, as you guys were familiar with too. We don't anticipate doing a lot proactively as the department. We'll be playing more of a reactive game this session. One bill that we are pushing forward is in 2014, Congress passed the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, which supersedes the WIA. What does WIA stand for? Workforce
Investment.
Thank you. Yes. The eyes change. So that supersedes WIA, which we administer. So we'll be changing our state code to align with what Congress passed last year. It makes some basic changes to our SWIFT board, and the one piece that affects this group and the unemployment insurance program is that it changes in our record sharing statute, which you guys are familiar with from last year, who we can and cannot share unemployment insurance information with. We will be changing WIA to WIOS, and that's it. That's all that's going to touch this area's code. So it's just an update. We're also making a minor change to our child care background check policy, but that doesn't have anything to do with unemployment. And that, again, is just aligning with what federal law is now. And that's all we're anticipating to push right now. We'll just be playing the game where we look and see and listen and play a little defense. But other than that, that's what it looks like. Do you guys have any questions or concerns, or have you guys heard anything? Because I can always use some insider information. Right, Dale?
Right. I can't help you with that.
Any
Exactly. And
yeah.
you just let us know what the bill number is on that,
yeah.
Because I get the shakes every time that we open up that statute that talks about the data sharing. And so I know a couple of very sneaky legislators that might, as long as we have the statute open, throw a little bit in here or there. I mean, I think that this debt collector piece is it's the beginning of opening Pandora's box,
yeah.
And we would prefer that everything else stay in the box.
Because it's really early.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will definitely let you know. Senator Wyatt will be the main sponsor on the bill. So I will let you guys all know what that bill number is. And that's the entire info that I want to hear. So if you hear people talking about touching our bill, that would be really, really great to know.
But the only thing that you're doing is really changing that acronym.
That's it. Mm-hmm.
So when other things appear, that's when we freak out.
Yep. Yes. We're not allowing any additional access. So if
Kathy will work at it. She's still working.
Is the bill go through interim committee?
No, it's not.
Can Kathy clarify that? So the section 312, which is the information sharing, the bill that includes that is going to include quite a few other sections of Department of Workforce Services statute, but it's only specific to 312, which is actually
right. There's lots of the other sections of our code that it's going to be affecting because it's changing all of our WEA program to EOS. But the only piece that touches the unemployment insurance provision section of our code is changing the acronym WEA to WEOS, and that's it.
So I say that when Jamie pulled up the bill and it's 20 pages long.
Yeah, don't be like, oh, we're changing the acronym. It's the unemployment insurance
provision. You guys know Dave too well.
He's looking out for our best interest. He wishes that. That's it.
Right. So without having any active legislation that's impacting UI aside from this one piece, we don't anticipate meeting with an advisory council during the legislative session, but would appreciate that if something were to come up that we could reach out for your insight or your guidance on that.
It seems like none of the councils ever intend to meet during the session.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Hey, Michelle, you're back on.
Debt collection. Let's talk about it.
Oh, that's a good segue right in there.
So there's a paper in your packet that has debt collection information amendments to the report. And essentially, Dylan, who was speaking to, in the 2013 general session, legislation was passed so that if a private debt collector is able to get a court order, then they can enter into a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Workforce Services, AAD, and we will provide them with information on the last employer for the individual that owes the money. So they can use this model for collection efforts. And this is similar to the report that was provided to council last year, just an update on numbers. With this legislation going into effect in 2013, during calendar year 2014, we saw a significant increase in the amount of requests that we were receiving. As of right now, we have 78 debt collection agencies that have entered into these memorandum of understanding agreements with us. Each time they ask for a name, we charge them a $15 fee, and that's for administrative purposes. So 2014, it amounted to about $423,000 in fees. 2015, the workload has definitely slowed down. I think what happened is some of the debt collection agencies that had initially supported this legislation waited to make sure we had all the administration down, and then they increased in 2014 with all of their requests, and now it's tapering off. We're still waiting to see what that consistent level of workload activity will be in the next few years. One thing of note is we had talked at the last council meeting in the audit process. to ensure that these debt collection agencies are adequately protecting our information and are using it only for the intended purposes of structure and the memorandum of understanding. As of right now, we're in afterthought with our administrative services division. By the end of this year, we anticipate having a certification letter. So all 78 of these will receive an annual letter that asks a series of questions that are not all certified, that they're protecting the integrity of our data. And then by the end of this fiscal year, we anticipate having a third-party entity where we can actually have go out and do an audit and insight on site. Of data security and the fact that the legislation opened the door a little bit, we want to make sure that our data is being used within those parameters and not beyond that. That $15 fee that's charged per request was intended to cover the cost of the auditing process as well. So it should be just self-sustaining in terms of funding. Because we haven't implemented the formal audit process yet, we're speculating what the cost of it will be. So I don't have definitive information.
What's the penalty if they're found in a violation? Say, if the audit comes back and says they're...
Debtor's prison.
$10,000 fine. I'll look at it.
So they find them all. It's not just word.
Per infraction or...
And have there been violations?
Kind of all of
we wouldn't know. Okay.
What do you attribute that significant drop off?
Do you think
that the debt collectors are finding that this information isn't as valuable as they anticipated it would be? Because we had almost 30,000 requests in the first year, and now we're. I mean, I like that trend. That's a good trend.
The economy's a lot better.
The economy's better too, so making people are
spending part of it.
Yeah, maybe that much in 1 year.
Maybe that's the whole thing, that's a part of it.
My reading is that in calendar year 2014, we had 1-3 entries that constitute the majority of that 25,000. One in particular that had, the largest employer has about 10,000 requests, and that was a backlog. And that was prior to the legislation passing. These are all of the debts that they wanted to get the information on. Once the legislation passed, we had the administrative processes in place. They kind of dumped it all on during 2014.
Do you have any thoughts or theories on the 3 months that are so substantially higher than the other months during 2015? January, March, and July. I mean, from June to July, pretty cold. Yes, there's a good theory.
And Mike, with your shop processing these requests, do you have anything to note from what they heard on the go?
You know, we don't get a lot of feedback directly from the private debt collectors other than they sure are happy to have our data.
So they do like the data.
Oh, of course. So people ask me if they're paying this much in fees collected, if I think it's valuable to them, and I don't have any definitive responses, but you've got to admit, why would they keep that?
They would keep that
dollar.
They've got an entire staff on somebody else.
But keep in mind, whatever the cost is, they're just passing it on to the debtors as well.
Yeah, they're not as crazy.
So that was one of my primary goals this year, was to make sure we've got a formative audit process in place. And so I look forward to the next council meeting so I can get an update on that.
And we can all remind Senator Bramble that he told us that there were only going to be a few requests. So.
Let me know how that works out.
We'll let Dave carry that
message. Yeah. Like me across the room. Like me across the room.
Any kind of
check on debt
collectors, or shall we move on to another information sharing?
Right.
And Kathy, let me know if you've got an update on that.
Yep.
Okay. Department of Labor wage and hour division. So this was House Bill 65 that went through last legislative session. After incredibly valuable insight from this council and coordinating with the Department of Labor and some talks with our state legislators, this essentially allows us, the statute that was passed is when an employer is found by the Department of Workforce Services to have inaccurately identified as an individual as an independent contractor rather than an employee. The value to a company for having an independent contractor is that they're not liable for unemployment insurance tax. They don't have a fire workers' comp coverage, or they also don't have any of the Fair Labor Standards Act protections, such as minimum wage and overtime. So when an employer is doing that incorrectly, it really hurts our economy, creates an unlevel playing field for other employers, and it hurts the workers by not having those protections. When we find that to have occurred, we are required to give that employer an opportunity to correct the wrong. Our auditors will go out, will spell out exactly what's happened, what the finding is, and what the liability is. And if the employer is compliant with us, then we will not share that information with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. If we've given the employer an opportunity to cure that misclassification and they fail to take advantage of that, then we will share the aggregate information from that audit with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division, whereas we're looking at it from an unemployment perspective, they're looking at it from a Fair Labor Standards Act perspective and child labor and that sort of thing. So they would be auditing something together. So there was quite a bit of concern that was expressed in different avenues regarding sharing this information. And how could we protect the security of it? How could we avoid creating more audits for our, more unnecessary audits for our employers? And what the gain to the state of Utah would be from that? So as of today, the law went into effect in May. As of today, we are in the final stages of executing the MOU with a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Labor. And I just wanted to walk through that because I know there were some explicit concerns from this council that we have certain things covered in the MOU process. So first and foremost was that employers were advised that if they failed to comply with us, their information would be shared with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. So this is just an example of the audit notice that we provide to employers when they're found to have classified workers. We did add a line at the bottom that says failure to comply with or contact DWS concerning the total due for audit findings may result in our plan to aggregate data from this audit with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division that provides the statute reference. So that's going out to all employers on their audit findings from us. And then in terms of the MOU, I believe we signed it internally. Right now it's with the Department of Labor Secretary to sign their view. So we do have a section that talks about that DWS will only share the information that's provided in statute, so it will be shared on an aggregate basis. We have a phrase that if it is found that the information shared is not mutually beneficial, meaning what we're sharing with the Department of Labor and what they're sharing with us, then we can stop the information sharing. There is also a clause in here that employers not subject to the Workforce Services Employment Security Act will not be shared with the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. And that basically means if you're an agricultural employer that doesn't meet that threshold for being liable for unemployment, we're not going to find you misclassified, therefore we're not going to share your information with the Wage and Hour Division. We also have a section that the Wage and Hour Division will use DWS information to conduct targeted investigations for possible violations of other labor laws, such as child labor, uncompensated overtime, and failure to pay minimum wage. So spelling out what they're using our data for. We do have a clause in here that prohibits them from resharing any of our data with any other entities. And we also are requiring that the Wage and Hour Division provide DWS with supporting information in regards to the effectiveness of this information sharing agreement. That was part of the ultimate legislation, was that we would report back to this council and to the legislature how effective this was and if we were seeing a benefit by sharing that information. So I didn't include copies of the final MOU because it hasn't been fully executed yet. If the council would like, I'd be happy to send that out once we do have the signatures.
It wouldn't hurt to have it.
Okay. Absolutely. Can I interject with an answer?
Yes.
It is $10,000 up in statute. It's a civil penalty. Technically, the way it's worded, we could ding them for each time they fail to comply with safeguards. The data safeguards that we put in place in the way. We could ding them $10,000. We can also recover any attorney fees that we would incur. So that's it.
Thanks. Yep. Does it read up to 10,000?
It does, but it says for each, if they fail to comply with the data safeguard, so then I would argue every time they fail, which would be on every hit of info, is a failure, and that would be $10,000 up to.
Any discussion regarding our information sharing?
Well, good job on that MOU. I know that those were many of the concerns that were raised, so thanks for getting that done.
Thank you for your feedback on that.
All right. VOA. Think we're starting for innovation and opportunity. So we went through and did a
very innovative.
Yes.
It was very innovative, changing a name. There's been a lot of changes actually.
So we went through a summary in our last council meeting, and essentially the purpose of WIOA is to make sure that the needs of the businesses and the workers are driving our workforce solutions. So rather than operating in a silo vacuum and breaking those down, is bringing our core partners to the table, three of which are currently housed in DWS. So our low-income adults, our youth, and our dislocated workers. The workforce development strategy is done in tandem with our adult education literacy program, our WAG advisor, and vocational rehabilitation. So they all come together. We have input from employers, from community organizations, from the public, to make sure that we're being strategic about our workforce development as a state. So that's what you owe in a nutshell. Three aspects that impact unemployment insurance. One is a focus on reemployment. The number one way for employers to reduce liability is to get people back to work. And so we are an active, we're not a core partner, but we're a mandatory partner to ensure that our reemployment efforts are included in this workforce development fund for the state of Utah. The second aspect is meaningful assistance. And we had talked about this in our last council meeting. When an individual is filing a claim for unemployment benefits, particularly if they're going into one of our local employment centers, that they're getting meaningful assistance. So if they need someone to help walk them through the application process online, if they need to talk to someone on the phone to answer a question about their eligibility, that we're providing that and we're collaborating with our employment center partners in providing that assistance. And the third aspect is information sharing. Because WIOA includes quite detailed section regarding accountability. And if we're investing in programs and we're having these initiatives, we want to show the outcomes and how they're effective. Part of that involves using wage records to identify employment trends. And so right now, as Kathy said, the only difference is we already have the ability in our existing statute to share information to evaluate outcomes for WIOA. This is just going to be being able to do that to evaluate outcomes for WIOA. One thing, the State Workforce Development Board, formerly known as the SWID, now known as the SWIDIT.
This is truly innovative.
Yes. Hard to say.
Hard
to say.
They are tasked, and that includes representatives from the core partners, community organizations, business, education, etc. They're tasked with putting together a unified plan for the state. And that needs to be completed and submitted to the federal government by March 2016. They are going to have a draft plan available for public comment at the end of January. If the council would like, I'd be happy to share that with you to look over and provide feedback, suggestions, and what you have.
Please, they're reviewing in the January 14th meeting, and then it will be public after that. Extensive.
we've got a representative there, I'm sure he'll fill us in. He's put the fill us in, that's great.
Yeah.
Might as well.
So we'll go ahead and email it out to the council, and if you have anything you'd like to add, we'll be happy to incorporate that.
Do you still on that, Dale? Are you still on the old SWIP board, Dale?
Oh, yeah. There's more than just a change on the initial. I guarantee it.
I think Dale had the pleasure of sitting through a two-hour meeting where we went through the ins and outs of...
And it was a pleasure, I'm on this.
I
I've stayed up nights thinking about that.
Right. Any questions regarding WIOA or the spring impact on the center?
Okay.
We're flying.
Still you, Michelle. Some more.
Open meetings training.
You can put that in a minute.
What? What is it here?
Large size. All
right, so with your handout, you have a page with open meeting act training, followed by incredibly small font, which shows the statute around the open meeting. That's primarily just for the reference. And I assure you that I will not read through the entire statute today.
Okay. Thank you.
So just a few high-level things regarding open meetings. The legislature requires that we provide annual training to anybody that falls under this section of the statute. And as a public body, the Employment Advisory Council is subject to the Open Meetings Act. The Utah Code under Section 35A, Title 4, lays out who the members of our advisory council are. That includes 5 representatives from the employer's side, 5 employee representatives, and 5 public representatives. And then the DWS Executive Director designated as a non-voting member. So the Open Meeting Act applies whenever there's a convening with a quorum present, which we're defining as a simple majority, whether in person or by means of electronic communications, for the purpose of discussing, receiving comments from the public about or acting upon a matter over which the public body has jurisdiction or advisory power. There are exceptions. Chance or social gatherings or public body convened solely for discussion or implementation of administrative or operational matters does not fall under this act. For meetings that do fall under the act, they require a notice of at least 24 hours to the public. That includes the agenda, date, time, and place. And the notice must be must be posted at the principal office of the public body, on the Utah Public Notice website, and at least one newspaper of general circulation or of local media correspondence. And so that comes in, thank you, with the help of Mary, that we're able to post that notice to the public. In terms of detail on the agenda, there needs to be reasonable specificity regarding the topic, as we cannot take final action on the topic unless it's listed under the agenda item and the public can do an announcement. Meeting requirements or minute requirements, the information needs to include the date, time, place, meeting, etc. And pending minutes must be made available to the public within 30 days after the meeting, approved minutes within 3 business days after the approval. So August meeting minutes are currently available on our website and chat form, and we'll get those updated as they go through. Recording requirements must include a complete and unedited copy of all open portions, and they must be posted on our website within 3 business days. So we do have a recording device in the room with us today, and I've been trying to use my booming voice to ensure that I get picked up on it. In terms of closing a meeting, so the statute does allow certain situations where we can close the meeting to the public to discuss character, professional competence, and the physical or mental health of an individual. If it's regarding pending or reasonably imminent litigation and investigative proceedings. So in order to close a meeting, we have to have a quorum present and 2/3 of the members present to vote. To approve the closing. each matter being discussed must be listed as one of those is permitted under this particular section of Utah Code. And we cannot approve anything while we're in a closed meeting. It's primarily for discussing such matters. When it is a closed meeting, we have to include documentation in the minutes, why it was closed, the location of the closed meeting, and a vote by name of each member, either for or against closing the meeting. We have some flexibility in terms of how detailed the written minutes need to be for that closed portion. And for the recording, we would need to include a complete and unedited record from commencement to adjournment. That includes the date, time, place of meeting, name of members present and absent, and name of all others present. If we violate the closed meeting portion of the statute, the person that's denied the right to be present may sue to compel compliance and request recovery of attorney fees. And members who knowingly or intentionally violate the closed meeting could be found guilty of a Class B misdemeanor.
So in your packet there's a small booklet, and we struggle with being such a large department in really articulating specifically to folks that might not know the depth and breadth and scope of what we do, including our own internal staff. And so really this initiated out of a leadership conference that we held. In our department, we have right around 1,800 employees, and we have about 250 folks in leadership positions across all of our, you know, four main divisions, but then also some of our other supporting divisions. We have quite a few people in management. And they really seek for opportunities across the department, want to know what other divisions do. So we put this together, and these are actually pictures of staff that work for us, located in the brochure. So that was a great opportunity for them. We wanted to explain who we are, what we do, what we're about in most of our public-facing divisions. And this was expanded beyond just an internal resource to use externally for key stakeholders, boards, commissions, legislators, those types of things. So there's some pictures. We wanted to put a face to a name for some of our leadership. So we think that that's helpful as well to be able to see who's who. And just, you know, wanted to make it available for folks if they wanted to order it. So this is our division overviews guide, and it's available to order, you know, if you want to put it on your Christmas list. It was a fun initiative because you know, believe it or not, a lot of people internally, you know, don't really know everything what Michelle Shop does, as well as housing and community development. There's a lot going on, and so this is just another initiative for us to communicate internally as well as externally. And actually, Kim Offerer over here put it together, so kudos to Kim for leading that initiative.
I'd like to point out that under the unemployment insurance section, this lovely woman is one of our experienced field officers. So she's actually going out to deal with various parts of the business regarding that in the past vacation question. And under the Division of Adjudication, we have successfully created this individual from Cathy Shop to work as one of our adjudicators. So they're talking to employers and claimants about job preparation.
I think it's neat that you were able to use actual employees.
Yeah, they have a fun time doing it.
Yeah, they're all
totally included.
Very nice looking.
Anything you want to add about it, Kim?
Yeah. And then the other department initiative was I included a copy of our most recent annual report that was submitted from the Worker Classification Coordinated Enforcement Council. And this is the body where the Department of Workforce Services meets with the Utah Labor Commission, the Department of Commerce, and the Utah State Tax Commission to share information about their classified workers. And every year we submit to the Business and Labor Insurance Committee the outcome of that collaboration. So this is the record for you.
Who are the members now?
who's representing the
So the Labor Commission has Jason Long in the Advisory Council. Department of Commerce is Tom Brady, our Deputy Director. And the Tax Commission is Lamar Prentice. And then just one more avenue that we're doing to coordinate with employers in terms of this misclassification in our audit program is this isn't included in your packet, but we recently developed a one-pager. So when an employer is found to have misclassified workers, to coordinate with the council, we're going to say, you know, here's also some additional entities that you may want to contact to ensure you're in compliance with them as well. And that includes workers' compensation and the update application.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Any other comments?
No, I just wanted to mention that I noticed something from the other day in terms of student abuse. I just want to get the status of Utah, and we had an effort to keep track of that. And
it's essentially when an employer incurs a high contribution rate, and so they close that business or they try to incorporate with another business for the purposes of getting a lower tax rate. It's kind of a way of essentially gaming the system to lower your contribution rate. We do have an individual in our shop that's dedicated to evaluating leads for possible data dumping. As of right now, we are able to stop them before it becomes an issue. We have had a few, I believe, I was just looking at the numbers for the last 2 years. I want to say it was less than 20 thus far where we have identified where they were incorrectly set up at a lower rate and what is then corrected the relationship and adjusted additional contributions. So we are absolutely looking at that.
Good. So we're still staying on top. It sounds like the man has more problems than we do. Stay in the battle with that.
Any other questions or comments?
It seems like every time we turn around, there's some more accolades coming this way. You guys are doing a great job. I mean, it's like you're over here, you're astonished. One another award. It's like, wow.
Well, I have the opportunity to accompany Michelle and Justin and Mike to Albuquerque to review that award from the feds. And I will tell you, these guys are superstars. They are actively sought out in and among their peers, and there's a well-established history with the UI leadership too. Set that stage, but they are well thought out, presented in several breakout sessions. Nationally, people seek out these guys to figure out how to run a good UI division. And so that was good for me to see, and I'm really proud of what they do. I mean, you're working spot on, which they do great things, and they're very innovative. They're involved in all of the committees nationally with NASWA, work search opportunities, pilots going on. They seek out Utah to look at those things. So, you know, it's just great to see. I'm proud of them. I mean, I'm part of it, but these guys work hard, and that reputation is definitely seen nationally. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Okay, so everybody, have a happy holiday season. I hope you endure the legislative session. I hope we endure the legislative session well. Yes, I was just going to say, and then can we have a motion to adjourn?
John,
I'll renew my motion.
Okay, thank you. Guys.